this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Tim Birdsong of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department about his work restoring Guadalupe bass in eastern Texas. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. A couple different listeners have suggested our guest today as someone they'd like to hear from, so finally reached out, and our guest today is Tim Birdsong. Tim received his bachelor's degree from Southeastern Oklahoma State University in biology and education and a master's degree in fisheries from Louisiana State University, as well as a certificate in nonprofit management from the University of Texas, Austin. Tim is currently a conservation biologist and chief of habitat conservation for the Inland Division of Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, where he coordinates efforts to restore and preserve the diversity of Texas freshwater habitats and species with an emphasis on the conservation of more than 240 species of native freshwater fishes and mussels. They occur in the state's 191,000 miles of creeks and rivers. For his work in restoring Guadalupe bass in Texas, Tim and his cooperators have received numerous awards from many different organizations. Tim also serves on numerous regional and national advisory councils and committees, including the Native Fish Conservation Network, National Fish Habitat Science and Data Committee, Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies Climate Adaptation Committee, and is past chair of the Southeast Aquatic Resources Partnership and Great Landscape Conservation Cooperative. Welcome to the podcast, Tim.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Tim, one of the two listeners that suggested you as a guest also mentioned that you are a pretty good baseball player. And before we started recording, we were talking about your sons playing baseball. And you were actually good enough to be drafted in the 1998 MLB draft. I guess, what was that experience like being involved in the Major League farm system?
Oh, I think it gave me a chance to grow up a little bit before I went to grad school. So it also gave me a chance to travel and see the country. I played in some minor league baseball leagues in the Northwestern U.S., Midwest, Florida, California. So got to see some really amazing parts of the country. I was studying to be a fisheries biologist at Southeastern Oklahoma State University. They have a really good fish and wildlife conservation program there. And so I was studying to be a fisheries biologist and actually had an internship with the wildlife department in Oklahoma at the time that I was drafted. And so I remember vividly the day that I was drafted because I was helping drain some ponds at a fish hatchery, and there were some screens that had to be scraped. These were some overflow areas where if you didn't keep the screens clean, then water would overflow this impounded area and you would lose fish. And so it was a really dirty job, something that you had to have somebody on site there 24 hours a day as those ponds were being drained. And so I remember the hatchery manager drove up and rolled down the window middle of the summer, just said, "Hey, your mom called and you were drafted." And I said, "Oh yeah, what baseball team?" He's like, "I don't know." And "What round?" "I don't know." And I had to finish my shift. And then I went home, connected with my mom, ended up connecting with a scout. I was drafted by the Cincinnati Reds. And so I met with a scout the next week, signed a contract. And I remember going back to that hatchery manager and just let him know that I was going to have to resign from that internship, which was a really competitive internship. I think most folks that work in the fish and wildlife community know how competitive those internships are and how difficult it can be to transition from school into a full-time career in this area of work. And so that was a pretty prized internship that I gave up, but I just had to take a chance and go try minor league baseball. So I played for the Cincinnati Reds for about four seasons and up and down the minor leagues. And I was married after the second season, and my wife and I just laid out some timelines and decided that, you know, I would give it a little bit of time to develop. And if it didn't work out as quickly as I wanted it to, then we would take that as a sign and it would be time to go back to school and finish that degree and move on with it. So that's what I did. I went back to Southeast Oklahoma State University, finished a bachelor's degree, and went on to LSU, got a degree in fisheries, went to work for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for their research program for a couple of years, and then decided I wanted to get back closer to home. Most of my family are in Oklahoma and Texas, so moved back and took a role with Texas Parks and Wildlife, and have been here for going on 13 years, mostly working in rivers and streams statewide and working on native fish conservation.
You kind of mentioned it a little bit. You had an opportunity to play in various corners of the country, I guess. Did you have a favorite area, that town that you visited or played in?
You know, the first town that I played in was Billings, Montana, and Billings had host families. And so there was a meet and greet the first week or so that we were assigned to this team. So most of the players had just finished their college baseball season, and I was drafted at the end of my junior baseball season in college. And so we finished the season, get assigned to a team, and usually practice for a week or so before games begin. But during that week, we're also trying to figure out places to live during the season. And so these host families, they offer up to players, usually rent-free or really low-cost option anyway, for them to live in a spare bedroom throughout the season. And that's usually like June through September time frame for the first season, which is considered your rookie season. And so I go to this meet and greet, and of course, As I mentioned, I'm already studying fish and wildlife conservation, and so I'm meeting these host families. And one of the host families, Jim Hansen, he's a waterfowl biologist with the state of Montana, and we just started talking, made that fish and wildlife connection, and his family ended up offering for me to live with them, and so I did. And it was pretty exciting because we were doing some duck banding, so he took me out, and we did in partnership with Montana Fish, Wildlife and Parks and Ducks Unlimited, did some duck banding, and I got involved in some of his waterfowl research just in the mornings. You know, usually had to be at the ballpark midday by lunchtime, 1-2 o'clock, something like that for a night game. And typically had these 4-game stands or 8-game stands at home. And then we were on these epic bus trips because we were based in Billings, Montana, but played teams in Idaho and Alberta and just throughout that region. So some really long bus trips, but beautiful landscapes. And I actually took my oldest son back to that area summer before last. We went to Livingston, Montana for a fly fishing event, and it was actually work related. I gave a presentation at this Fly Fishers International meeting, and we actually, Texas Parks and Wildlife received an award there for our River Access program, which we partner with fly fishing clubs here in Texas to lease private lands for public access and conservation of our state fish. Guadalupe bass is a big part of that because we use all of those access areas as conservation demonstration areas, and those are kind of focal areas for doing river cleanups and habitat restoration projects and other things. And again, most of that centers around helping conserve our state fish, but expand fishing opportunities, whether it's kayak fishing or bank wade fishing in some of these really beautiful, clear spring-fed streams in central Texas. But yeah, I got to take my kid back to Montana and see some of my old stomping grounds from early baseball days. But yeah, that definitely some really cool memories there. And that fish and wildlife connection that I had with the Hansen family, that was pretty cool. And we've stayed connected up until today.
As you mentioned, you're currently back in Texas, and kind of mentioned it briefly, the state fish of Texas is the Guadalupe bass, and is one that you've spent a lot of time working on or working with. Could you describe to the listeners what makes this species of bass different from the others?
Well, this is a riverine fish. It occurs only in these clear spring-fed streams in central Texas and nowhere else in the world. And I'm sure most listeners are familiar with largemouth bass, spotted bass, smallmouth bass. Guadalupe bass is one of 6 or 7 unique forms that are species that occur across the southern U.S. that have really limited ranges and occur in these flowing systems. And so in areas where we've had impoundments or had habitat degradation due to urbanization or other changes on the landscape, we don't tend to find Guadalupe bass in some of those areas. And so Guadalupe bass was selected as the state fish back in 1989, specifically because it's associated with these really scenic, just beautiful streams that I think most Texans have a high appreciation for. Most folks that live in Texas, a big destination in the summer months is river tubing on the Guadalupe River or the Kamal River, some of these other central Texas streams. And of course the Guadalupe bass, I mean, the name, it's named after the Guadalupe River. That's the namesake river. And it's just a really beautiful place. I've had a chance to work with other biologists across the Southern Europe to conserve endemic basses that are real similar to Guadalupe bass in terms of their habitat requirements and their life history. Species like shoal bass and Swanee bass, red-eyed bass, these are just some of the species that occur in limited drainages in Georgia and Florida and Alabama. But in total, there are 10 species of black basses, but roughly 20 different unique forms of black basses that occur across across the U.S. And so just in Texas alone, we have Guadalupe bass, we have spotted bass, which primarily occurs in the eastern half of the state. We have a native largemouth bass and some of our rivers, some of the Rio Grande tributaries, like the Devil's River. We have a unique form of bass that we just kind of generally refer to as Devil's River bass, but it has some unique characteristics that are different from largemouth bass, but real similar to largemouth. It's considered right now a subspecies of largemouth. And then across the border in Mexico, there's a Cuatro Cienegas bass. There are these desert wetlands, just clear, beautiful, kind of pond type of environments that are in a closed basin in the middle of this chain of mountains. And so this bass occurs there that's referred to as Cuatro Cienegas bass. And then, as I said, quite a few other riverine forms that occur across the some of the Gulf tributaries and streams that drain into the Atlantic through South Carolina and Georgia. The Choctaw bass is the most recent form or species of bass that's identified. It occurs in some coastal streams along the Gulf. There's some other unique basses that occur in Oklahoma and the Ouachita mountain streams and Ozark streams. And so we're still finding these unique forms of riverine basses that occur around the southern U.S. But this Guadalupe bass has been something that we've put a lot of focus on, a lot of conservation focus on over the last roughly 25 years, a little bit over that now. But we began stocking, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and predecessor agencies began stocking other forms of bass throughout Texas in the early 1900s. Our first stockings of smallmouth bass in Texas were in the 1930s, just with the idea of providing another fishing opportunity, not really understanding the implications of stocking smallmouth bass, because now we know smallmouth bass will hybridize with Guadalupe bass. And we didn't know that in the 1930s, 1950s, we stocked some streams and then started up a pretty substantial smallmouth bass stocking program in the early 1970s that continued into the early 1980s. And many of these streams that I'm referring to in central Texas, west of the Austin-San Antonio corridor, many of those streams were stocked with smallmouth bass. And then in the late 1970s is when we documented this hybridization that was occurring. And there was a concern that we were going to lose Guadalupe bass and that it would be extirpated from the rivers where smallmouth bass had been stocked, or even, the potential for it to go extinct. And so there was an initial Guadalupe bass conservation plan that was assembled in 1991. And we worked under that plan for the next 25 years, and lots of really significant accomplishments in terms of restoring Guadalupe bass to different streams, and have broadened the scope of that work to really try to push forward a multi-species watershed approach where we're trying to conserve biodiversity in some watersheds. And there's a ton of pride around the natural heritage of Guadalupe bass. I mean, there's pretty strong, if you're not from Texas, and you've interacted with a Texan, I'm sure you're very aware of how prideful Texans can be. And so there's a lot of pride surrounding state fish and desire to help maintain populations of the state fish, and landowners that live along certain rivers really desire to have the state fish in their backyard and their home waters. And so we have a litany of conservation partners that have come together that are from anglers to paddlers to conservation nonprofits, private landowners, our donor network that's helping provide funding to cover the cost of this work is pretty impressive, but lots of supporters to help conserve this unique fish that only occurs in these really beautiful streams west of Austin and San Antonio, and that area of the state is a destination for most urbanites. I mean, you especially folks that are in Austin, San Antonio. This is where people go road trip on the weekends. This is where we have the wineries and the breweries and the bed and breakfast, and it's just a really beautiful place that people like to visit. And Guadalupe bass is part of that draw.
You mentioned a little bit the loyalty that a lot of Texans have to their home state and the pride they take. And the state fish designation kind of brought a lot of attention to some of the issues faced by the Guadalupe bass and made it easier to push some of these conservation efforts. I guess, what was the first step in restoring some of these historic populations?
I guess 1889 is when the species was recognized officially as the state fish, and then we crafted this conservation plan. And soon after that, in 1992-93, there were conservation stockings of Guadalupe bass into some streams on the southern edge of the Texas Hill Country that where Guadalupe bass were not native, but also where no smallmouth bass had been stocked. And so there were three areas that were stocked that became refuge populations. So genetically pure guads were there. And so that protected the species. We knew that we would have a source of pure Guadalupe bass to draw from. And that, of course, predated my time with the agency. But these refuge populations were established. And then a range-wide genetic assessment was implemented to identify where we had hybridization, and it was pretty rampant throughout the range. So most streams where smallmouth were stocked, we had some level of hybridization. And then I need to recognize Dr. Gary Garrett. He formulated the strategy in the early 1990s to attempt a genetic swamping effort where we would stock so many pure Guadalupe bass into a system that it would just overwhelm that system and, you know, beyond the carrying capacity of the system, and hopefully allow for those Guadalupe bass to just outnumber the hybrids and the smallmouth and outcompete and hopefully drive down hybridization levels. So that really was initiated as an experiment, and that proceeded over the next 20 years and into the 2009-2010 timeframe, and it was successful in driving down hybridization rates in the headwaters of the Guadalupe River. So we have a Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, Heart of the Hills Fisheries Science Center. This is our research station. They're located in the headwaters of the Guadalupe River Basin, and so right out back behind the fishery station there is Johnson Creek. It's one of the major tributaries of the Guadalupe River, and so that was really where a lot of these concepts were tested. And then in 2011, we were in a really serious drought in Texas, and to the point where we implemented some salvage efforts for several imperiled species. Brought some species into our fish hatchery system with concern that they were on the brink of extinction. And so we were looking at opportunities to support Guadalupe bass conservation during the drought. And one of the ideas that we came up with for another river, the Blanco River, was to try to address or support potential removal of smallmouth bass and hybrids from that river during drought conditions, because the river had been relegated to a series of disconnected pools, a no-flow situation. But this particular river, it's a recharge area for the aquifer, for the Edwards Aquifer. And so the idea of using pesticides, any kind of chemicals, would probably not be supported. And so we just ended up using block nets and electrofishing and seines to just try to remove as many of these smallmouth bass and hybrids from pools as we could. And this was from a reach of river that was above a major waterfall that serves as a barrier to upstream movement of fish. And so from this waterfall upstream to the headwaters, we targeted pools where we could remove smallmouth and hybrids and actually used, it was kind of our first use of unmanned aerial systems. So we used a drone to fly the riverbed and map all of these pools, and then cooperated with the Nature Conservancy, who had a land conservation program underway in that watershed, and had some really good relationships with landowners. And so they reached out and contacted landowners of properties along these pools that we wanted to remove smallmouth and hybrids. And so we were able to gain access there. Otherwise, we would have been traveling by ATV, potentially up and down the stream bed. So this really helped facilitate access to those pools. And in 2012 and 2013, conditions improved in the state, and with some solid rainfall, flows returned to the Blanco River. And so we stocked about 500,000 Guadalupe bass above that waterfall in 2012 and 2013. And Guadalupe bass are sexually mature after a couple of years. And so we've been monitoring ever since, and have documented successful spawning and recruitment. And we've since then raised the flag and for successful reintroduction of Guadalupe bass into at least that, that fragmented reach of the Blanco River. And so one of the other strategies there at the Blanco was, let's restore a population above this waterfall. And we know that we're seeing some downstream recruitment of Guadalupe bass. And so over time, you'll hopefully have the same effect that Dr. Garrett had with his research project in the Guadalupe River Basin, where you're continuing to have this infusion of pure Guadalupe bass into those downstream hybrid reaches. And hopefully over time, you'll see a downward trend in the level of hybridization within the Blanco River. And then several other rivers where we've taken similar approaches. We partnered with the city of San Antonio and Bexar County and the San Antonio River Authority on a channelized reach of the San Antonio River that flows downstream of the San Antonio Riverwalk, which is kind of a big destination there in the city of San Antonio. There's also the San Antonio Missions, which are a big tourist destination. And in between those two markers is a series of neighborhoods. And so city of San Antonio, they wanted to do a stream restoration of this channelized reach of the San Antonio River. So try to restore a natural floodplain and a pool riffle run system and restore habitats and native species and add a kind of a nature trail and hike and bike trail along the river there. So they reached out to us and said, yeah, they would really like to see the state fish restored into this urban reach. And so we began partnering with them. And over the last few years, we've seen some natural recruitment of Guadalupe bass and that system, which is pretty exciting because it's this stream that's in the middle of this heavily urbanized area, and now you've got these urbanites that are out there fishing for Guadalupe bass and just under the San Antonio skyline. So that's pretty exciting because we're in Texas, we're shifting from a rural state to a decidedly urban state at this point. And so the bulk of our human populations are in Dallas-Fort Worth, San Antonio, Austin, Houston, a few other major urban centers. And so we're constantly trying to get these urbanites to care about some of these natural landscapes, particularly these streams in rural areas that we would like to see them use and care about. And and species like Guadalupe bass, it's the bulk of their range is kind of removed from these urban centers. So most folks would have to travel west from Austin, San Antonio, up into the hill country to experience one of those streams. But it's pretty cool that we have the state fish just right there in that downtown area. And then we have some other intact populations of Guadalupe bass that we're trying to keep that way, and where we've built some really incredible partnerships with the landowner community, where we're implementing this these large scale watershed management efforts. We've laid out some practices, some land management practices that really benefit the health of these streams, and doing everything from grasslands restoration, riparian restoration, conservation of springs, just, you know, trying to work holistically across the landscape to conserve the health of these rivers. And sometimes, you know, you're connecting with partners and, you know, maybe the interest there is protecting downstream water supplies for municipalities, or maybe it's something other than fish and wildlife, but we've had a lot of success in just finding these shared interests. And so we've had places like the Pernalis River watershed, which is west of Austin near Fredericksburg, that it's kind of a wine area, a lot of vineyards, and where we've been able to connect with landowners and through conservation easement workshops and riparian restoration workshops, we've just generated quite a buzz around land conservation and seeing a lot of really good things happen there to protect this pure Guadalupe bass population that occurs in that system. And then the lower Colorado River downstream of Austin is another one of the places that we work. And in that case, this is downstream of Austin. It is mostly wastewater that you're seeing flowing down that river, but Austin does a really good job of treating and managing their wastewater. And we have there's a flow agreement that supports base flows in the Colorado River. And then we've historically had some other flow components that were negotiated as part of the water management plan for that system. And so we have some spring pulses that have been focused on supporting the spawning needs of state-listed blue sucker, but obviously those flows also provide some real benefits to Guadalupe bass, because we have a really healthy Guadalupe bass population down in that system, and it's viewed as our trophy Guadalupe bass fishery. The state record Guadalupe bass, which these fish don't get huge, but the state record Guadalupe bass, a little under 4 pounds, was caught from the lower Colorado. And I know for a fact there are lots of other new state record Guadalupe bass that are in that system that just haven't been turned in yet, or haven't been weighed in. But yeah, those are some of the streams that we work in, and there are about 13 different streams that we're doing some kind of work in right now across Central Texas to conserve Guadalupe bass. Back in 2010, we partnered with some of these other southern states, Georgia DNR, Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission, South Carolina DNR. There were quite a few other players involved in that, but we put together this conservation plan for these riverine black basses that occur across the southern U.S. And it was a 10-year conservation plan, and the portion of it focused on Guadalupe bass. We set a goal of maintaining or restoring 10 genetically pure, self-sustaining, fishable populations of Guadalupe bass over the next 10 years. And so this year, in 2019, this is the 10th year of that plan. And pretty cool that we achieved our target. So we achieved that goal of 10 populations conserved or restored. And so we just partnered with Bass Pro Shops and the Texas Council of Fly Fishers International and the San Gabriel Fly Fishers and Living Waters Fly Fishing Shop, and just launched a pretty cool prize giveaway program. It's just trying to create a little bit of a buzz around our state fish and all the effort that's going in to conserve the rivers where it occurs. And so in kind of North Austin, Round Rock, Georgetown, this is an area that's, as you move from Austin towards Waco and kind of central, north central Texas, there are a couple of streams there, Brushy Creek and the San Gabriel River. These are tributaries of the Brazos River, where we have Guadalupe bass. And so we stocked 40 tagged Guadalupe bass with these Floy tags. And there's a phone number on the tag to report your catch to Texas Parks and Wildlife and be registered for this prize giveaway. But all these partners donated fly fishing gear, you know, just everything from rod and reel combos to, you know, fly kits, waders, other sorts of gear that that they are given away to these to the anglers that catch a tagged fish. And of the 40 fish that we stocked at the end of March, I mean, it's been 2 weeks since those fish were stocked, and 16 of the 40 fish have already been caught. Two of the fish have been caught twice, and just the first angler to catch those didn't, they took a picture and didn't cut the tag off. And so, so yeah, 18 anglers that have reported catching tagged Guadalupe bass. And anyway, it's just, that's amazing. 18 out of 40 fish, but also it's just indicative of the high interest in stream fishing in Central Texas, especially in these urban areas around Austin. So yeah, we did an economic impact study of stream fishing in Central Texas back in 2015. And it was pretty amazing to find that over a 16-month period, stream fishing in this part of the state generated about $71 million. And roughly half of the effort that was directed in the region was at Guadalupe bass. So a lot of interest in fishing for Guadalupe bass, kind of growing interest in stream fishing throughout the state of Texas. And we're a state that really over the last 50 years or so has been known for reservoir fishing. So we have some really incredible Florida bass fisheries and reservoirs. We also have some great striped bass fisheries and some great catfish fisheries. But yeah, I mean, most people thought of Lake Fork or some of these other big bass lakes. But now we're seeing an expansion into maybe a return to interest in stream fishing in Texas, because you know, prior to the heyday of reservoir construction, Texas was a state of rivers. I mean, we have 191,000 miles of creeks and rivers and streams. That's pretty much the aquatic landscape in Texas. We had a couple of natural lakes that are really just, you know, log jams on rivers. But we didn't have any natural lakes. We have you know, a significant number of impoundments, river impoundments, you know, reservoirs. But you read back through some of these historic agency reports that we have from the 1920s and 1930s, and the things that our biologists were focused on back in that time period are the same things that we're focused on today as we're trying to manage Guadalupe bass in rivers and streams. And, you know, we like to think that these holistic watershed conservation approaches are something new and innovative, but you read back through these reports from the 1920s and 30s, and yeah, biologists were trying to address erosion and sedimentation and trying to conserve riparian corridors and provide riparian shading and maintain water quality and all these things that we're doing today. And so that's why I say kind of a, you know, for the biologists and anglers, kind of a return to rivers and streams in Texas.
With that return to rivers and streams, you're trying to help anglers and recreational users get access to some of these streams that, I guess I'm not 100% certain, but I'd imagine Texas is landowners own all the way to the middle of the stream, and you have to have landowner permission to get on a stream.
No, it's a little different than that. So we have some interesting laws where if a stream confluence to confluence averages 30 feet or wider, that's just kind of the general description, but you know, 30 feet or wider, then it's considered navigable. And so of the 191,000 miles of rivers and streams in Texas, roughly 40,000 miles of those streams are considered navigable and are considered navigable and state owned. And so as long as anglers can get to the stream, then they have the right to navigate on that stream. That includes just hiking up and down the stream bed, because it doesn't necessarily matter if there's flow in the channel. If the channel is 30 feet or wider from confluence to confluence, and you know, that's not always the rule. There are some precedents that have been set from some court cases, and we have a land office here in the state that goes out and have a chief surveyor that makes some determinations. So it's kind of a case by case situation, but yeah, we have probably you know, like I said, 40,000 plus miles of stream in the state that are considered publicly navigable. And so we have greater than 95% of the state that's in private land ownership. So that's reflected in ownership of riverbanks as well. So most of their riverbanks are privately owned. A good number of stream miles are publicly owned publicly navigable. So you have stream crossings where you can access. You have some city, county, state parks, wildlife management areas, other public lands where you can access streams, but still really limited. And so we established a program back in around 2006, the Texas Paddling Trails Program, where we tried to formalize agreements with local parks that had river frontage and establish these clearly marked put-ins and take-outs to promote just kind of these safe, reliable, family-friendly reaches of river where people could go and know that they're not going to have issues. They're not going to, it's unlikely to be conflicts with local landowners. They're going to have a place to park. They're going to potentially have local services, shuttle services, or canoe and kayak rental companies, things like that. And so that program has really taken off because communities around the state have realized the nature tourism benefits, the economic benefits tied to promoting river recreation. So that's really taken off. But meanwhile, it doesn't change the fact that we don't have a lot of public lands in Texas. And so back in, I think it was 2002, we launched a program where we were leasing private land along the Guadalupe River for a seasonal trout fishery. And this was mainly leases with tubing companies that offered seasonal camping and seasonal tubing during the summer months. And so the winter was considered kind of a downtime for them. And they were really interested in ways to make some money in the winter months. And so we began partnering to pay these mainly campgrounds and tubing companies for anglers to access the river across their properties. And so that continued through 2011, 12 timeframe. And then the U.S. Farm Bill had a new program that was authorized, the Voluntary Public Access and Habitat and Center Program, which funds leasing of private lands for public access to fishing and hunting opportunities. So we applied for and we were awarded a couple of competitive grants through that U.S. Farm Bill program and began kind of testing the waters just with some initial pilot projects. The idea of year-round leases on warm water streams. And so back in 2012, I think we signed seven leases on three different rivers, and those were five-year agreements. And that was kind of our proof of concept phase. And then we've just continued to expand from there, and we're up to around 20 of these leased fishing access areas. Meanwhile, there are fly fishing clubs that have established some of their own lease programs, and I know that's popular in some other states, the use of private land leases for at least club fishing access and probably public fishing access. But this is something that we've kind of worked through, again, the proof of concept phase, and now we're ready to really push it out, and have worked with landowners in a variety of different settings, where you have absentee landowners that don't live on site, to landowners that have hunting operations or other active farm, ag operations. And we've just worked through a lot of different scenarios now and have come up with some strategies for how we can make use of those properties for anglers and paddlers. And so that's working pretty well. And probably our most successful use of that, of leases as a tool, was on the Devil's River. This is probably the most pristine river in the southwestern United States. It's in southwest Texas near the city of Del Rio. And so we had a reach of the Devil's we had a public stream crossing, and then roughly 18, 20 miles downstream of that was a Texas Parks and Wildlife Department state natural area. And then another roughly 20 miles downstream had another Texas Parks and Wildlife state natural area. But again, 20 miles, I mean, that's a really long distance to try to paddle, especially if you're trying to fish through that area. And so very remote area, kind of some difficult paddling conditions, but well worth it if you can get out there, and if you're prepared and you're in shape and you're just used to that kind of a rugged experience. But a lot of folks would go out there and they weren't as prepared as they needed to be, and again, a really long stretch of river to paddle. And so routinely had people that would paddle into the nighttime hours, create some unsafe conditions, dump their boat, lose all their camping supplies and run into some issues or pull over and camp overnight on the riverbank, which is for the most part, those areas are privately owned. So they're trespassing, and that resulted in conflicts between anglers, paddlers, and landowners. And so we came up with again, the strategy to use leases as a tool to enhance that opportunity out there. So we negotiated these paddle up only overnight camping areas on the river to provide some dedicated campsites for folks that wanted to take on a 2 or 3 night fishing adventure on this river. And that's been really successful. And so we had a program that monitored trash and trespassing issues, you know, just like documenting illegal campfires and other sorts of things along the river, just reports from landowners. And we definitely saw a downward trend in the amount of trespassing, the number of conflicts between paddlers and landowners, and the amount of trash, primarily camp gear that was found in the river. So we've held that up as a pretty unique success story, but yeah, working in a private land state like Texas, I mean, we are really blessed to have the river navigation laws that we have, and for the state to have retained ownership of these riverbeds. I mean, these are state-owned riverbeds, and so the public has the right to recreate on those if they can get to them. And so we're still trying to expand this program, but we've definitely added some safe, reliable, high quality access to streams over the last 20 years or so, and hope to continue to grow that program. So that's been exciting. We do have some areas that are under Spanish land grant where the property surveys were drawn to, as you had suggested earlier, you have a survey that where the line goes to the center of the channel in some cases. And even in those, we had some legislation that passed in the early 1900s that for even if those property surveys are drawn to the center of the channel, the state of Texas still retains the ownership of the sedimentary material in the stream bed, and the public still has the right to navigate those areas. So it kind of goes back to that 30 feet or wider rule that from confluence to confluence. So yeah, I mean, we have some pretty cool opportunities to get out and experience rivers and streams in Texas.
Well, Tim, thank you for filling us all in on the Guadalupe Bass and a little bit about the leasing programs you have going on down in Texas. But now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
Well, I mean, I'd be hard pressed to come up with a fish that I'm more, I guess, professionally and personally attached to than Guadalupe bass. So I guess I'll say Guadalupe bass only because I have so many really cool stories that I could share from my immediate family. I've gone some really fun, memorable fishing trips with my dad for Guadalupe bass on streams. But my home waters here in Southwest Austin, where I live, is Onion Creek. It's a tributary of the Colorado River, and my kids have grown up on that stream and been catching Guadalupe bass since they were 3 years old. So it's a fish I've been pretty committed to for most of my professional career, and the entire time that I've been a dad, I've been working with Guadalupe bass and my kids, at this point they have my Guadalupe bass presentation in their back pocket. They could probably give it better than I could.
You mentioned you have quite a handful of good memories related to Guadalupe bass. I guess, what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Some of these recent accomplishments that I talked about, restoring Guadalupe bass to the South Llano River, achieving this 10-year conservation goal that we had set for the species. I look back, I reflect over the last 10 years and just where this started. And I can remember the very first paddle trip that we did with partners on the South Llano when all of this was still just very conceptual. But yeah, we organized a paddle trip just to go down the river, talk about conservation challenges and talk about capacity within our organizations and what we can bring to the table. And, it really surpassed any expectation, just I don't know that I would have believed that it would have, everything would have come together and just fallen in place the way that it has. And it's really been a cool success story for us that now we're trying to replicate in other areas of the state. But yeah, the Central Texas is such a unique area because we have quite a few local conservation nonprofits that are all stood up to help preserve the, you know, what's unique about Central Texas, what's unique about the Texas Hill Country. And a lot of people care about those natural landscapes and want to do right by fish and wildlife. And so it's been really rewarding to work with a group of folks to set a goal that at the time, 10 years out seemed like a really long time. And now, you know, reflect over the last 10 years and it just passed so quickly. And I compare that to some of the other conservation programs that I've worked with on other species around the state or regionally. And, you know, this has definitely gone really well. And it's something that I'm proud of. And we have another 20 or so staff within Texas Parks and Wildlife that has spent considerable time and effort to help with the success of this project. So just a huge team effort here in the state and connected to regional and national funding groups that have supported us. So I would say some of the outcomes that we've had for Guadalupe Bass are definitely up there as some of the best memories that and the most rewarding experiences that I've had so far in my career.
I think it's obvious to any listeners out there the passion you have for Guadalupe Bass and the area that you're working in and all the different projects you have going on. I guess would it be safe to say that this is your dream job or dream location?
I would say yeah. I mean I look over the fence just like everybody else, and you look around the U.S., you look at other jobs within your own organization or other organizations in the region or state that you work in, and I've come to that realization that I'm really blessed, and Texas Parks and Wildlife Department is definitely it's a really awesome organization to work for. The Inland Fisheries Division is I believe a well-respected fisheries program nationally. And so, yeah, this is a great gig, and I'm blessed to be working here with a great group of colleagues. I can't think of another job that I'd rather be in, and to live in a place where my family has been such a big part of many of the projects that I've worked on. I mean, my kids have been tagging along with me on projects for their entire lives. And so I said this earlier, but I mean, they're fully engrossed in it. They get what I'm trying to do and, you know, the issues that we're working to address. And it's kind of fun to hear them regurgitate some of the things that I'm trying to promote to partners, to landowners, to others. You know, they've got those talking points in their back pocket. So, pretty cool place to work, pretty great organization to work for. And really beyond that, the broader conservation community in Texas. I mean, you look at all the other state agencies and conservation nonprofits and angling clubs. It's a great community to work in that's really supportive of the things we're trying to accomplish and really try to think outside the box. And so, yeah, I definitely can't complain. And I do interact quite a bit with biologists around the U.S. And I would say that for the most part, fisheries biologists, we all really enjoy our jobs. We care about those resources that we're working to conserve. We didn't go into this career expecting to get rich, or we didn't go into this career because of, you know, the desire to have accolades or anything. It's really just, you know, something we're passionate about. And I feel like, every time I go to a state meeting or fish biologists, you know, an American Fishery Society meeting, a state chapter, Southern Division, or, you know, the Parent Society meetings, just interacting with other fish biologists, it's an inspiring bunch. And, you know, people that really care deeply about what they do. I can go back to undergrad when I made this decision to pursue a career in as a fish and wildlife biologist. I remember thinking at the time, because I was in a biology program and it offered some opportunities to do some shadowing of different careers and that a biology degree could lead to. And so I remember I did some shadowing in some medical offices and connected with this one office, and had done enough shadowing to have interacted with a few patients that were dealing with some health issues. And meanwhile, did some shadow work with some fish and wildlife biologists, and it just kind of looked across the spectrum of careers, that whether it's pre-med or pre-dental or other things that you could go into with a biology degree. And I just thought, I care really deeply about natural resources. And, it seems to me like even if I don't make as much money being a fish and wildlife biologist, that I would do what I love, and I would be able to feel like that it's not work because I care so much about it. And so I'm out there, doing what I love, and I'm not working to make money for my next vacation or my next trip where I get to get away from that job. It would be a career that I could feel like I'm really making a difference. I'm working on something I care about, where I'm not looking to retirement. I'm doing what I love. And so that may have been pretty idealistic at the time as an undergrad, but I'm 15, 16 years into my career now. And I don't think it was a mistake. I mean, at this point, I'm really glad that my path in life led me this direction, and that I've been able to pursue this career as a fish and wildlife biologist. I love what I do. I love the people that I get to be around. And I'll just stop there.
All right. The fourth question: if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
I can think of several projects that I'd like to work on here in the state. There are a few rivers that are just highly altered that we've drained of some really cool natural channel design restoration type projects, and some places that had some historic sand and gravel mining. And so we thought that there was the potential for some floods to move through those systems and rework those areas and try to and potentially put things back towards more of a functional state. But we've experienced quite a few significant floods, some 500 year flood events over that time frame, and those have not really helped restore that system. And so we've got some big ideas on things we could do, and we're actually trying to piece together some money to make those happen. But it's these big river channel restoration projects. They're just the engineering, design, permitting, funding. There are a lot of pieces that have to come together. And we've got a few that are on the radar, and we'll see if we can't push some of those forward before the end of my career.
All right. The final question: if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
It's really difficult to get people to think big picture about the connections between the uplands and the watershed, these watershed connections, and how the health of land and land management practices influence these headwater streams and even groundwater and springs and the creeks and rivers and the recreational experiences, or the downstream water quality or water quantity. All of these things are connected, and those rivers and streams and their headwaters, their watersheds, these are all the lifeblood of the state. It's one of these issues where I think people will, anglers, paddlers, others will see some local issue in a stream, and it seems like something that they can, they want to address there locally, but usually there's the cause of that issue is further upstream, and this is just a symptom that if we address there locally, we're just putting a Band-Aid on it. And so trying to get people to look upstream and think about how the activities that are occurring are impacting things downstream, and hopefully get people that live in those headwaters areas to understand the effects that they have downstream. And so just I guess the interconnectedness, how we're all in particularly in Texas, like I said, it's a state of rivers. So, you know, we're all living, almost every major urban center is along a river. And so we're all having some impact on other people downstream, and the people upstream of us are impacting us. And so it's just, you know, how interrelated all of this is, interconnected it is, and how we should be really working more and, you know, in a community and working through, you know, these collaborative stewardship processes to try to work through the and understand the trade-offs that occur, because development, increased water demands, you know, there are needs that are met by groundwater pumping or surface water withdrawals, or maybe there's some economic growth that occurs because of some urban development in a particular area. But, you know, just for people to think more big picture and understand the direct and indirect impacts of those activities on other areas is going to be really important as we move forward in the state, because we're definitely in Texas, we're moving to that point where, you know, the level of human population, you know, it's to the point where we're going to have to get really smart with the way that we manage water and look towards ways that we can address competing demands, you know, meeting the needs of fish and wildlife while meeting human needs. And so it really can't be looked at as competing demands. I mean, they ultimately are, but we've got to look towards solutions that can meet both. And as long as we're saying, you know, looking at it from a perspective of, well, people are more important than fish, you know, then it's really just not that simple. I mean, it's more complex than that. And if we dig a little deeper, then I think that we can find some solutions where we can meet the meet needs of humans and where the needs of fish and wildlife are not inconsistent with addressing those human needs. So we have a few positive examples of that where we've tried to work with some dam operators and lake authorities to look at ways to manage downstream releases to meet downstream water supply needs while providing flow patterns that enhance recreation and that provide maximize habitat value for fish and reaches of rivers. So there are some really good examples out there. And so I think just the complexity of these systems and the need to identify beneficial outcomes for people and fish and wildlife, it's complex, but it's not too complex to look the other way. I mean, it's not something that we need to shy away from. We have some really good examples where it's being done, and we should try to do more of that. And that's something that if municipal planners and engineers and biologists and landowners and, you know, communities, the more people that start to recognize the ecological and recreational and economic values associated with rivers and streams and with some of these aquatic species and with paddling and other water-based recreation that occurs on rivers and streams. I think people are starting to value rivers and streams for those reasons more so in Texas than they have in the past. And I think it positions us really well to be able to, for recreation and, you know, ecological systems to be viewed as having a seat at the table in kind of larger scale planning processes. And so I think we're headed in a really, really good direction. I'm hopeful that during the rest of my career, I can help promote some of those, some of that understanding that it's all connected and we can work together to find solutions.
Well, Tim, thank you again for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and your projects down there in Texas. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
You can check out the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department website, and my email and phone number should be readily accessible there. I work with not just Texas Parks and Wildlife, but get some cool projects going in partnership with the Southeast Aquatic Resources Partnership. That's another organization that folks could check out. And then the Native Fish Conservation Network. I think you could do Google searches for any of those groups and access information on what those groups are working on. But a lot of really cool projects going on around Texas and the southern U.S. And really appreciate the opportunity to share with you and listeners.
If you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 33rd episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember to think big picture about watershed connections and interactions.